All right, welcome back to another Sunstone podcast. I'm here today with Blair Osler. Osler, is that right?
Yeah.
I had some Oslers in the family. Maybe we can try to, isn't that the Mormon game? You try to connect the families.
And if you take into account polygamy, like we're pretty much all related.
Oh yeah. And yeah. You do your genealogy and get back there into the mid 19th century and it just goes bonkers. It's all bananas.
True.
I've been looking forward to talking to you and thanks for coming. So first of all, congratulations. This just, I swear these two weren't related, but you just got appointed to the board of directors of Sunstone.
I did. Right. Yeah. Yeah, I'm really excited about the opportunity. I've been a big fan of Sunstone, and I really love what Lindsay has done with Sunstone. And so I'm just really happy to be a part of it and give back.
It's fun. You know, we were just walking through the building here. You've been here before.
No, this is my first time actually here in the Sunstone office.
And the Sunstone offices are really fun. I'm not even sure how long they've been here. It's obviously, you can tell it's been a long, long time. Mm-hmm. I think Lindsay and the Sunstone board and the folks behind the scenes are really looking at reinventing Sunstone in some really powerful ways. I've said it several times. You know, I went to Sunstone 5 years ago, and now you go to the conference in the summer, and it's different. It's like Lollapalooza.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, so I'm glad you're here on the board. Hopefully you won't have too many discussions about the naughty things that I've done, but you can prepare yourself for that. I've met the board members. It's a great group of people, and it's a really fun time, I think, to be a Mormon. But it's a sad time because things are changing fast and there's a lot of people who are trying to reconcile who they are now and the world we live in now with their belief and their passion and their faith. And that's why I'm really looking forward to this discussion.
Yeah, great. No, I'm looking forward to it too.
Okay, so maybe let's get a little bit of your history. We always used to start and say we were born in the covenant.
People
don't do that as much anymore, but that was a starting point because you know you can't remember the pre-existence, so it's hard to
I can, others can't, right. But I can.
Clearly we weren't part of the one third that got thrown out, so that was the first major success right. In our life, right?
Yep.
How'd you grow up in the church?
So I had a interesting upbringing in the church in that it wasn't totally your typical upbringing. My father was in the military, so we moved around a lot. And so we went to a lot of wards that were like, you know, eight people in the basement of a building in Korea. And so a lot of certain Mormon culture things were a part of my life, but not totally. There was definitely some liberty when you're out on your own in these other places to just kind of make things work the way they need to work. And, you know, you just kind of figure it out as you're going along. I mostly grew up in Washington State, though, so it was pretty liberal. So some of the issues that took place in Utah with Utah culture didn't really apply to me either. My father was actually excommunicated in my youth too. And so we didn't really have a priesthood holder in the home for a while, me and my sisters.
Wait, so in Washington, yeah. I have to ask my weird questions. Yeah. There's sort of three schools of Mormonism. You know, there's the West folks, the Seattle folks, and the Couve people. Uh-huh. Which group were you in?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I was in my own group. I was in La La Land. I was in the queer group. I'm like, there's like four of us and just like, yeah, we're queer. It's totally fine.
So even growing up, you took that identity?
Well, oh, not openly. Not openly. So there were a couple of kids I knew who were queer in one way or another. Like one of my friends was gay, but we never were open about it and talked about it. It was just kind of this unspoken thing. We all knew that it was like this, but we're just not going to talk about it. It just wasn't really something that was a big deal as far as like, even from the church is concerned. Like in some ways, growing up being queer when I was, you know, this was back in the 90s, it was a little bit easier in some ways because there wasn't this overt, horrible push to like just totally be dominating queer people just because the culture was kind of like that anyway. So the church didn't have to be. So right. We all knew like this was unacceptable. But at the same time, we didn't get it so in your face at church.
Yeah, I've talked to friends. I graduated in 91. I have friends who were gay then and are mm-hmm. gay now, of course.
Yeah.
And we talk about the time, you know, at 91, it was still illegal. It was still criminal.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So a lot of these queer and LGBT communities were underground. Mm-hmm. And the point I'm driving to is a lot of friends that I have now who are my age and they're in their 40s or 50s. It's disorienting now, like because there was this identity of we're different and we're like in a club. You know, and now when it's kind of out there, I think it's a harder place to find. It's this irony that we're more accepting, but in some ways it kind of diminishes the cultural cohesion. And we'll get into more of that later. Okay, so you grew up, you had found some other queer kids that you identified with.
Yeah, totally, and wasn't really a big deal. It was kind of like a don't ask, don't tell thing. It's totally fine, whatever. I was very much disillusioned with certain truth claims and authority claims with the church. Because my father was excommunicated, it just really became glaringly obvious. There are some fundamental problems in the chain of command and the hierarchy of the church and how women are being treated. So that was a very early disillusionment for me in my youth. Mm-hmm. So that's greatly affected the way I've engaged with the church. Even at a young age, it was just like, no, patriarchy's not perfect. And it's okay to say you're overstepping your bounds.
Well, and things like the patriarchy, misogyny, systematic dismissal of women and minority groups is so pervasive.
Right.
It's just everywhere. Once you, if you're like a white male who's grown up in kind of that privilege, you oftentimes don't see it. And there's these kind of, and I've been that guy, you know, it's like, we're accepting. I don't know what you guys are talking about. And once you start to see it. And just so I haven't talked about this very much, but I have two transgender children. They're teens, late teens. So it's been a real interesting experience as I've been attached to that community, especially the mental health side of that community.
Absolutely.
And it's there and it's around, and it's really, you're up against these systemic things where people are constantly marginalizing you and pushing you aside in ways that they don't recognize that they're doing.
Oh,
so
yeah.
When you raise your hand and say, wait, we're second class, like, they say, we don't know what you're talking about. So then you're like, okay, where do we start? Let's start in 1961 or, whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and it takes a lot to sit and deconstruct those attitudes because, like, exactly what you're saying, it's so pervasive in the culture that we can't even acknowledge that, like, certain people are being treated poorly because it's just like, you're not being treated poorly. We're equal. You're just here and I'm here, you know?
Right. And for conservatives, they say, there is no problem. And liberals, they say, oh, there's a problem out there. I'm just not part of it.
Yeah, right. There's a problem. It's just not my problem.
Yes, exactly. All right. So you went to BYU.
I actually went to UVU and I went to BYU and then I went back to UVU. I had a very hard time coming out to Utah and just adapting to Utah culture. And I was a fine arts major. I'm an artist. I mean, I love frolicking in my garage naked with a paintbrush, right? So like I'm definitely very much a free spirit in that regard. And it was a big transition for me to come to Utah country in Provo and go to school and like, what's this honor code business? I don't like people keeping tabs on my business. And so I actually went back and forth for a while and then ended up leaving and getting my first degree at an art school in Seattle.
Wow. Yeah. And Provo is its own thing too. I experienced the same culture shock when I went there.
Yeah.
Like I'd grown up in Utah virtually my whole life. And I've used the analogy. I was a Mormon. My family were Mormons. We were Mormons. And you went to Provo, and Mormonism was something that you do and not something you were. And that was kind of a little bit shell-shocky to me, too. And I think it's unfortunate that the Utah Mormon culture, we were just talking before we recorded about Mormons who don't go to church. And like, it was very pervasive in my family. There are a lot of people, you know, in generations past, that going to church didn't identify you as a Mormon, nor would it identify you as not one. You know, 40, 50 years ago, no one say, oh, there's Grandpa Joe. He hasn't been in a church since 1935. He's not a Mormon. But they would say that now.
Right.
Right.
Well, yeah, there's definitely a difference in the culture now to where it's less about Mormon as an identity and more about an orthopraxy. If you practice it the right way and if you're doing it the right way, right? And it's almost pharisaical.
and it's a cultural thing, too. I was reading something about this, all this Con Marie sort of like trying to get your life in order.
Yeah.
This idea that if you can just do everything correctly, then everything else will follow.
Right.
And that's something I think as the Mormon culture and the Mormon faith is slipping in its predominance, and people, even very faithful members who aren't giving it the deference they used to, as they're pulling for identity, there's always that group that sort of doubles down.
Oh yeah.
And they can be kind of dangerous when they're cornered, you know?
Because
they're scared. Like the rest of us are or were. You know, this thing we grew up with, it's not exactly what you thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care if you have a slip of faith, let's say 1% or 75%, it's all scary.
Right. It really is. I mean, There's no doubt about it. You can definitely see the fear in people that comes out towards right now, like the queer community or Mormon feminist community, when it's just like, you can't come in and change these ideas. I have it, my stake in the ground. This is where it's at. You know, things never change. It's always the same forever, tomorrow, and today. It's just right. Like, that's just not even Mormonism. We got, you know, we've got continuing revelation, the restoration. Like, we are all about being dynamic.
And it's always been changing. And yeah. that's whenever I talk to reformers, I'm always like, I don't know what you want to reform to, because it's been, I like how you frame it better. It's been a dynamic, you know, changing thing. So you met your eternal companion down there?
I did. I met Drew at BYU. We were in the same apartment complex, and I actually had a missionary at the time too, who I was totally planning on being married to. And so I like to joke that my fiance or my boyfriend became my fiance, and then my fiance became my boyfriend, and then I had to let my boyfriend go so I could marry my new fiance. So there was a bit of an overlap there, but I met Drew there. We were married about 6 months later, and honestly, it's kind of been happily ever after. Like, I can't complain. Like, I love being married. I love my husband. I don't regret a single day of it. And I'm totally head over heels in love with him. So I really lucked out in that department.
Well, that's fantastic. And you have three kids?
Yep, three kids. They're awesome too. 11, 8, and 5.
Oh, they haven't turned into monsters yet. You still got them in the...
Exactly. This is the best phase. You have no diapers, no naps, and you have no dating and any of that to worry about. It's the sweet spot.
My favorite time was basically, I don't know, 8 to 11, 8 to 12, because they still think you're cool.
Mm-hmm.
And you can still say, hey, let's go catch butterflies in the park. And they're like, all right. And yeah, that changes.
Totally.
You'll survive.
Yep.
Well, let's cut to the heart of the matter. I mean, in LDS culture, any sort of non-traditional sexual identity or gender identity is generally not well understood. And I think often I'm shunned because of that lack of understanding, as opposed to like hate. But I mean, that's there. But so you identify queer.
Yes.
So what does that mean to you?
Yeah. So I use the word queer in a few different ways. I use it as an identifier for myself. I also use it as a label, an umbrella label for the whole LGBTQ community, because honestly, all the letters just get really long. So it's just easier to say queer community. And I also just use it, you know, colloquially, like queer, peculiar. So for me, being queer is a really good identifier for my sexual orientation and my gender experience. I have gender variant biology. It's comparable to some intersex conditions.
I don't know what that means. Gender variant biology.
Oh, okay. So like with biological sex, most people would define it according to usually five categories: your chromosomes, your internal reproductive anatomy, your genitalia, your hormones, and your gametes.
So all the phenotypical stuff.
Yeah. Well, yeah, pheno. Yeah, exactly. Other than chromosomes,
the stuff that's coming from your genetic makeup.
Right, right. So me, I have some variations of that. So I have really weird internal reproductive anatomy. I also have really high levels of testosterone. And that's changed the way that I experience gender. It's not typical of your average woman.
And I'm going to give an example out there, because we have listeners who, because of how they grew up, are not exposed to this at all. You know, we know that there's, you know, XY makes a male and XX makes a female. But there's a point, like, for example, in gestation, where there is a hormonal surge that happens.
Yes.
And if that hormonal surge doesn't happen, then you can be an XY female.
Well, yeah, exactly. Your phenotype would be typically what's assigned as female.
Right. I'm using the female in quotes.
Yeah, yeah. No, totally.
And I'm not trying to dig into all these things like that, but just know that the gender is oftentimes a lot more complicated than conservative, especially conservative religious things, make it out to be.
Oh, absolutely. The science of biological sex is way more complicated than man and woman. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't work that way. Biology's too queer for that.
Right, right. I like that. Okay, so you grew up that way, and that led to we're talking about gender, like then there's the other component.
Yeah, then there's the sexual identity. So I didn't know necessarily what was going on with my body until puberty. Once women regularly start menstruating and stuff, I didn't start menstruating till a lot later. And when I did, it was horribly painful, and I started throwing up and all sorts of horrible things happening. And so I started to realize there's something different going on inside your body, your internal reproductive anatomy. And it wasn't until later, until I attempted to have children, that I found out the full complex complexities of everything that's going on with my biology. Long story short, through the miracle of technology, I have three amazing kids. My tubes are tied. I'm done. I almost died and I'm just done. So I'm happy I have my babies. But anyway, biology is weird. You know, anatomy is weird. But for sexual orientation, I recognized that much sooner than I understood my own internal biology. I want to say I was maybe in sixth grade when I first started noticing boys, and it was shortly thereafter that I started noticing girls. And so people are always like, oh, which do you prefer, anything? I was like, really? I just noticed boys first, and then I started noticing girls, and that was all there was to it. And growing up, I genuinely believed, and I don't know if this is like a common bisexual experience, but like I genuinely believed that all girls were attracted to girls and all girls were attracted to boys. I genuinely thought I was normal until I grew up and other kids told me I wasn't normal. I was like, oh, so not all girls like girls. And honestly, blew my freaking mind. I was like, how can girls not like girls?
Well, in my experience, you know, having had a lot of late night conversations with a lot of people, I don't think you're that far off the mark. my own personal belief is, and there's biological and evolutionary evidence to suggest this, mm-hmm. that most of us are not as binary as we would lead to. And I think what you're seeing is a lot more bisexuality that's openly tolerated among females, and there's still a huge stigma, and we can see, you know, that and unfortunately this is because society still looks at the feminine as being inferior, mm-hmm. and this is why even people who are very tolerant will find that trans men are often much more tolerated than trans women, mm-hmm. because to be, you know, biologically a man who's taking on a woman's thing, even for progressive people, right. they'll look down on them.
Oh, they're, it's a demotion.
It shows
Absolutely.
This underlying misogyny. Gender bias, misogyny that is almost universal. It's pervasive. It's not a male female thing.
Right.
Our society, our culture has been so misogynistic for so many thousands of years that people don't see it.
Oh,
even
yeah.
when it's internalized.
No, totally. And I'm glad you brought that up too, because so many times people want to walk into queer issues and talk about these things without talking about just basic things like prejudice against women and misogyny and all these issues that are tied up in it. I mean, you can't talk about homophobia without talking about misogyny, because so much of it is wrapped up in, well, which one of you is going to be the girl? Two right. men can't be right. together. One of you has to be the dominant one, right? And it's like, well, you know, I don't even know where to start with that.
Right. Right. And I, you know, I deal with, because of my children and then who comes and, you know, I have four kids and they're all very open and very tolerant people. So there's a lot of queer and LGBT kids that come through my house a lot.
Yeah.
It's kind of a safe space. I probably shouldn't admit this, but I think we've bought five binders. Mm-hmm. Or we bought binders for five different people, you know, because their parents won't let them have them.
Mm.
So, I'm not always, well, we've supplied five binders around, you know, but a lot of these kids where I struggle is wanting to, and you kind of hinted this, wanting to pigeonhole things. I like the term queer, because
yes.
I think actually in reality, we're all a lot more queer and than we want to let on, or bisexual, or, mm-hmm. and there's evidence even in like heterosexual male porn. I don't want to get into it right now, but you can go read yeah. about how male porn, the porn is very much about male homoeroticism.
Sure.
And so I think like we have a stigma, especially for men, that they can't do it. But we're starting to open that up with women, which allows people to come out more naturally to what they really are.
Well, yeah. And I think there is something about that too, to where like even lesbianism or sexual acts between women are taken as seriously as sexual acts between men, right? Because with lesbians, it's like, you know what? And again, it's very phallic-centric. Well, if there's not a phallus involved, is it even sex? There's no harm in two women getting together to cuddle, you
right.
know? Like, because there's no phallus involved, to where it's like with two men, it's like, oh, we have two phalluses here. What are we going to do? Of course, this is all cis normative what I'm saying right now. But there are definitely some issues with just looking at the intersections of gender and sexuality. And I'm really glad you mentioned the idea of queer too, because that term has become really comfortable for me specifically, because the bi community has gone through so many different variations of what to call themselves, because bi, you know, sometimes you get criticized and be like, oh, well, if you're bi, you're only attracted to two genders and you're promoting the gender binary, which negates, you know, the experience of, you know, non-binary people. And then you say, oh, okay, I'm pansexual. And pansexual means means I am attracted to any gender. And then your straight friend comes by and says, pansexual means you're attracted to everyone all the time for everything. And I'm like, just because you're hetero doesn't mean you're attracted to all women all the time, does it? And so you keep going through this long list of names. We have omnisexual, polysexual, and all these different names for like the bi experience.
The teens
and
it's just have like, more of them. Yes. That's I try to keep up. You know, I consider myself to be a very PFLAG oriented, mm-hmm. supportive parent. I've told them, I'm like, why do you guys need so many labels? Mm-hmm. Just be whatever you could. You know, I've told all my children, you can sleep with whoever you want. yeah. you know, be healthy.
Right.
Don't hurt people. Don't use people. But you don't have to label it. You right. don't have to decide, you know, whatever. Yeah,
so the label thing is so tricky, right? Because it's a two-edged sword. For me, I like queer because it's kind of like saying, I'm Mormon, ask me more. You don't know what that means, but I'm Mormon, ask me more. I'm queer, ask me more. And part of the reason we have invented all these different labels is because there's all these external forces being like, well, you can't call yourself this. You can't do this. Da, 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 da. And so here's the problem. If you don't label the experience at all, though, sometimes it gets into tricky territory where people are like, if you don't name the experience, it's almost as if the experience doesn't exist. And it's okay to neglect it or be homophobic towards things and things like that if you don't name it. And so it's this borderline between like naming an experience, but then not giving it too much power by giving it the wrong name. And so it's really complicated. Like as far as like the culture is right now, the not naming it, this is totally your millennial Gen Z. And I love it so freaking much. I mean, Godspeed. Like, it's really just a matter of I am who I am and I like what I like. And I don't have to tell you all the details about it. And I love that attitude. Older generations, like maybe Gen Xers, baby boomers, and on up are like, well, if you don't have a legitimate name for the experience isn't real and we can put you in conversion therapy.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And they want a pigeonhole. I mean, if people follow LGBT issues, they know this is the case. There's oftentimes a low level animosity between the gay community and the bisexual community. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and one of the, And because the gay community has such a coming out thing, when bisexuals come out, sometimes they're met with criticism from the gay community saying, you're co-opting our experience. And because there's this truth that if you're anywhere, and I'm using bisexual open for all these things we've talked about, queer and pansexual and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's a better term. What term should I use?
Bisexual is totally fine. We know what you're talking about.
So the, you know, one of the issues, which is a legitimate thing, saying, well, you guys can hide that, like, mm-hmm. bisexuals are in normative heterosexual relationships. Mm. They don't necessarily have to come out. And the problem is when they do, there's this underlying assumption, I'm sure you've experienced this, if anybody identifies himself as bisexual and they're in either even a heterosexual or a homosexual relationship, there's an assumption that they're always sleeping with other people. Mm-hmm. There's this bias towards anybody on the bisexual spectrum that they cannot practice monogamy. And they get that from both mm-hmm. sides. They mm-hmm. get that from the gay community and they get it from the straight community.
Right.
And,
right.
and I'm sure when you identify yourself as being, and I'm not trying to fish for you to say anything, but yeah. when you say you're a married queer person, mm-hmm. people immediately want to know about your girlfriends, I'm assuming. You know,
I get all sorts of questions about that. Absolutely. Well, and I think also this idea too of sexual orientation and prejudices within the queer community is just a really sensitive topic, right? Because there is a certain amount of privilege for someone like me who's married to someone. I get heterosexual passing privilege.
Yep.
All the time. And so I try to check that privilege when I'm in queer spaces. At the same time, this is exactly what bi erasure is. It erases yes. the bi, it totally erases the bisexual experience and says, well, because you married a man, you don't experience homophobia. You don't experience internalized shame or guilt or anything. It's like, no, I experience all those things too. So it's really just walking a tightrope, you know, between being aware of your privilege, but not letting your experience be erased.
Which is a hard line to walk.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I do not claim to do that perfectly
for
at all.
All of us who, you know, as trying to be a supportive father and a supportive friend, you know, I walk mm-hmm. paths through this community, but it's very difficult. You have a lot of different experiences that we're umbrelling, mm-hmm. trying to umbrella underneath one term. And of course, somebody's sexuality and just intimacy, let's not even go to sexuality, the intimacy they have with is all going to be individual.
Right.
And whenever we start throwing this whole thing together, you know, it's very strange. I'll tell you one of my biases, and I'm not the only one who shares it. I wouldn't take my kids to gay pride when they were young because I didn't want them to And I'm fully on board with whatever kind of expression. Let me make this absolutely clear. I think Pride has been absolutely essential and for people to come out of the shadows and express their sexuality and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want my 9-year-old there trying to explain to them, like, you know, male gay bondage, the male gay bond flow.
So
I only use that example not to criticize anybody, but say it's a complicated community.
Absolutely. No, totally. And people ask me that a lot too. So like, what do you do with your kids, Blair? You're so open about all these things and you talk about these issues. And I do take my kids to Pride. I mean, my little girl, she's been growing up going to Pride. And so we do have a lot of open discussions and things like that. And really for me, especially when it comes to kids and LGBTQ issues, for me, it's definitely about providing spaces where they feel comfortable asking the questions.
Right.
And it's really okay to say, I don't know. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, and I think that's important that we recognize, that children recognize we don't have all the answers, but we can talk about them and figure it out together.
I think that's fair. And let me say this, I was wrong. Like, I should have taken my kids to Pride when they were younger.
Well, and it's a personal decision, too. Right. I'm not trying to, say anything. And everybody's at a different place, too. And depending on the child, like, honestly, my oldest is on the spectrum. And so, like, he didn't come to Pride just because, like, he could not handle the overstimulation and everything. Right. And it was just too much. So every kid is different. Every person is different. And we all got to express ourselves in different ways.
Hi, I'm Stephen Carter. My job is great. I get to gather the best articles, essays, stories, and poems from Sunstone Magazine and narrate them for the Sunstone Magazine podcast. It's the best of Mormonism in an audible quality recording. Some of the people Sunstone has published include D. Michael Quinn, Jana Reese, Gregory A. Prince, Elna Baker, Dan Weatherspoon, Gina Colvin, and John Gustav Rathal. Head over to patreon.com/sunstone to listen to some of our free episodes. And then join us for the best of Mormon thought and experience.
And me personally, I'm not even like a huge love parades and crowds and noises myself, but I think it's important for me to participate just because it makes a firm statement to see a Mormon girl in a pride parade and say, no, I'm still very much Mormon and I'm still very much queer, not giving up either label.
Excellent. Okay, so your queer identity has fed into your philosophy and your theology. And as a matter of fact, we'll mention it in the end, but you've got a book that's about to come out.
Oh, yeah. Well, I certainly hope so. I'm still shopping for publishers, but I'm really excited about it. It's basically on queer Mormon theology, and which is almost redundant for someone like me to say, because from my perspective, Mormonism is already inherently queer, and it's already queer friendly and already queer inclusive. We just need someone to come and spell it out so we can show people the way.
We'll spell it out. I do
in 500 pages.
So how do you say Mormonism is queer friendly?
Okay, so I think the first step is making the clear distinction between, there's an idea between Mormon theology and then LDS church culture and policy. So these are two very different things to me and how I experience them. And I focus more on the queer theology. If someone's trying to come in here and say, the LDS church is totally queer welcoming, what are you talking about? I roll my eyes. That's okay. There's a difference between being welcoming, as in you can walk in our doors, and being affirming and inclusive and saying you can come to our temples and you can baptize your children and things like that. So I'm in no way trying to negate that all those serious problems in LDS culture and church policy still exist. They do. But with Mormon theology, on the other hand, I see a lot of potential in our theology to make this as queer inclusive as possible. So there's been a lot of great work done on this already, and I build off a lot of this work. And some of the ideas are just as simple as, like, Taylor Petrie had a really great dialogue article on a post-heterosexual theology, in which he talks about the creation story taking place with three men, and three men create Eve's body, and all of a sudden Eve's body's here, and not a woman was mentioned in this creation process. So is this asexual reproduction? Is this homoerotic creation? What is going on in this narrative? So it's my belief that if we sit down and really look at our scriptures thoroughly, we're going to see, oh my goodness, this is so much more queer than I originally thought.
I'm glad you bring that up, because especially post, like, 60s, Mormon theology became very concrete and very literalist in a way that's caused us unending problems because, you know, like you're talking about in the temple, when you read, you know, let's say the creation myth that's in the Bible, which of course may not be translated correctly. Then you read the one in the Pearl of Great Price, which has to be translated absolutely correctly.
Absolutely.
Then you have the one in the temple. They're not, you can't even reconcile those three. And two of them come from modern revelation, right?
Right.
So, so I think the right response or the intellectually most obvious thing is to say, well, these are myths. They can't be taken literally. We can't, there's no way to reconcile the fact that they're creating Eve in the, you know, in the temple creation myth and gender is eternal and people have been around forever. Right.
Or even more so the mortal model of reproduction requires, you know, a penis going into a vagina during ovulation to create a 9-month gestation period. And then, you know, people are like, that's what it's going to be like for Heavenly Mother. I'm like, we're talking about a goddess here. Do you think she's wasting her time with 9 months of, like, per kid? You know what I mean? Is time even relevant to a god? What is a gestation period for a god? So when we take these existential questions a lot further, we're just going to go, yeah, we need to start thinking about this way differently.
Well, I like that you bring that up because it's always like scratch my head because you're talking about what is the goal? And and that's it. Families are forever. Like, like what's the point of Mormonism? You're going to distill it all down. What's like, well, we can die and then we can have our families back and we can keep keeping the family model. Then my question is, well, what are those beings? Like, because they don't show up in our theology at all. Like human beings that are born to perfected parents. That seems to be the whole goal of the entire theological point, but they have no theological space.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So the crux of my book is I focus a lot on the idea of theosis, which is taken from Joseph Smith's King Follett sermon, which, you know, no matter what anyone says, I'm like, it's Mormon doctrine, forget it. You can keep your family proc. King Follett's sermon is totally doctrine. But so if the purpose is for God to create more little gods and those little gods to grow up into big gods like God is, that's the focus that we should be focusing on. And all the other issues are tangential to that idea. And this gets all wrapped up in Jesus Christ and his example and how we do these things. And with that, when we look at the way gods create and different ways we grow and the different way we experience things, there's going to be a broad, broad, broad spectrum of ways we can engage in these ideas of like creation. So like for one example that I have in the book is I talk about the idea of Mary being impregnated by her heavenly father.
Which for the 19th century Mormons was very literal.
It was very literal. And Brigham Young even came out and quoted all these things. This is a literal experience. This is not metaphorical. And just, you know, to the 9 yards, the full 9 yards of it. So if Heavenly Father impregnated Mary, then that means Heavenly Father is both the grandfather and biological father of Jesus. And if that's the case, that makes Heavenly Mother and Mary sister wives. And if they are sister wives, oh, that also makes Heavenly Mother what would you call it? The sister wife mother of Jesus, but also the spirit mother of Jesus. And so when you start to break down all these family dynamics of, if we're going to take this whole thing literally, let's do it. Let's take it literally. It starts to go, whoa, this is either way queer or we need to start thinking about this metaphorically.
Well, I like that you brought up that example because that's one that they've tried to solve. And fundamentalists and early church fathers tried to solve it by saying that both Eve in particular, but, because you're getting the whole Adam God thing, but Mary were actually already wives of God that he brought down and sent. So you start getting these weird sort of ways to work around this stuff.
Right.
So I mean, I like the idea of sort of looking at Mormon theology in a prism that makes it more accepting of this. But I have to ask, I mean, fundamentally, I think Mormonism problem with sex here stems from the fact that they want a single sexual union that has no other outlet. So if we have a queer theology, how do we reconcile that with, I don't want to say monogamy, but absolute sexual fidelity to one person?
Yeah, so that's in the book too. I'm so glad you brought that up. I have a model that's called queer polygamy, and this is an original model, and I'm actually really looking forward to it. It's also going to be a chapter of the book, and it's also going to be published in Dialogue shortly in the spring issue of Dialogue. And basically, I address these issues in the queer polygamy model, which basically talks about ideas of of polygamy versus monogamy, and how can we reconcile these ideas of we're requiring some people to be monogamous, but then in celestial glory in the highest degree, you are not going to be monogamous, you're going to be polygamous, or at least polygynous, right? You know, this is going to take a very male-centric spin, but in the queer polygamy model, it breaks down all those barriers and takes away marital relationships being equivocated to sexual relationships. And then we dive into sealing relationships and talk about, well, what if we looked at polygamy as a sealing practice instead of a sexual practice? And when we start thinking about plural sealings to people, we got the law of adoption, kids born in the covenant, you know, I could be sealed to my best friend through whatever types of sealings. So it's really about broadening our idea of all the things Mormonism could include.
Well, I really like that you bring that up, because I accuse ex-Mormons, especially ex-Mormons right out of the church, so often of just bringing their whole paradigm with them. And one that I'm pushing back actively on, you see this construction all the time among Mormon critics. They'll say this: Joseph Smith stole other men's wives. yeah. And they say that all the time in various formats.
Because wives are already owned by men, of course, because so he
wives,
stole them.
Wives are something that Joseph Smith stole. But you could easily say about early church polygamy, these women stole other men's husbands. Mm-hmm. Or you could say, what's the more rightful thing, especially before Joseph Smith died, that you're right. There were sealings going on between men. There were sealings going on between fatherly sort of things. Mm-hmm. And it's true that those polygamous relationships were often sexualized, but they weren't necessarily sexualized. And I think the ex-Mormons in particular, and the evangelicals and others criticizing the church, get so caught up in one man having sex with multiple women. They have this puritanical view of that that makes them blind to everything that was going on there. And I cannot for the life of me understand why everyone keeps framing Joseph Smith polygamy as this male oriented, because I mean it was a patriarchal church.
Oh my gosh.
But women were marrying multiple men were marrying multiple women. There were dynastic ones. That what you're describing more describes Joseph Smith polygamy than what we think it does.
Exactly. So a lot of my book does harken back to the early church, because I won't be quoting a lot from like the 1970s on, because that's when it all goes downhill for me. I'm like, no, we need to get back to our roots, minus the androcentrism and patriarchy.
Right.
But one of the best examples I ever heard of it, what you're talking about, is someone asked this guy, I was listening to it on a podcast, and I won't name who it is, but if you dig through all the Mormon podcasts, I'm sure you'll find this. But the male interviewer asked the male historian, could you explain to my viewers what polyandry is? And he goes, oh, sure. It's when one man's wife marries another man. And I'm just like, you make polyandry about men. How do you do this? This was like our thing. And you made the man the center of attention in this.
And you see in surveys, again, I'm sorry I'm beating up on the ex-Mormon community, but they'll have these questions like, what is the thing that broke your shelf? You know, that's the phrase that ex-Mormons like to. Yeah. And polyandry comes up all the time. Mm-hmm. And what that's the inherent sexism you see.
Yep.
They're fine with polygamy. And as soon as they find out that rather than say, oh my God, the church was egalitarian in Nauvoo. Mm. Like the women could have multiple husbands. Mm-hmm. And they did.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
These women in the Relief Society, I mean, let's be just blunt about it. They were sleeping with multiple men. And it's that fact that doesn't fit this paradigm that is still used commonly to talk about Joseph Smith and these guys dominating women. Now, let's be clear. I think Joseph was more of just kind of a swinging, happy guy who was good time. Brigham Young, we go into full-scale
patriarchy.
Yes,
yes,
right.
Absolutely.
So that was put to death in the Utah period by Brigham Young.
Yeah, absolutely. And I address a little bit of that too. Just the idea of it's really complicated when we start to talk about the differences between polygyny, polygamy, polyandry, and how they were practiced and what this means in the afterlife or any type of celestial existence, and how is this going to come to be. And I think one of the biggest tensions you see, even among like your most faithful Orthodox going Latter-day Saints, they would never even call themselves Mormon. They would call themselves Latter-day Saints. And even they have a hard time accepting this idea of, oh my gosh, if I want to be in the highest degree of celestial glory, I'm going to have to share my husband with another woman. Like, that is so difficult for some of these women to grapple with, that they just shut down. They shut it off. They can't even have the conversation. And so these are some of the things we need to address too. The inherent sexism in these plural relationships. So like, for example, even right now, women can't be sealed to multiple living men, but men can be sealed to multiple living women. For women, you have to wait until someone dies. It's like, oh, congratulations. Thank you. That's super helpful. So we can't, again, address these idea of like queer issues, polygamy issues, and just plain old sexism. They're all intertwined with one another.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Anson Park, Executive Director of the Sunstone Education Foundation. I want to invite you to our weekly Sunstone Firesides. Do you remember those? Firesides that they used to have dating all the way back to the 1930s, when the LDS Church would hold monthly meetings to discuss really important gospel topics. Those meetings became known endearingly as Firesides. In January of 2019, Sunstone launched a new podcast that incorporates a nod to these firesides. Featuring a weekly evening podcast, it will display a range of hosts, all women, as they chat with diverse guests from across the Mormon spectrum. The hosts are all female-identifying that represent a broad perspective in Mormonism. These podcasts will be released every Thursday evening, so you can have that fireside feel brought right into your living room. So grab a cup of cocoa or coffee, since at Sunstone there is more than one way to Mormon. Snuggle up under a blanket and listen to incredible interviews by and from incredible people. You can support women and their work in Mormon studies, which is desperately needed, by donating at sunstone.org or becoming a monthly subscriber. Go to sunstone.org and click on the podcast tab for more info. We hope you enjoy it as much as we do.
You're absolutely right, but the church has stripped everything that's female away. And I made this point over and over again. If you even go back to like 1972, and the church was so much more empowering to women, and it was the post-ERA when women's rights were just stripped out of the church. And you can still go downtown on Temple Square, and there's the Relief Society. But they had their own building. They had their own organization, and it was all taken away. So I see why some women find the idea so troubling. Because that's the only thing they have left. The only thing they have left is a claim on one man. Yeah. And to be able to say, he can't go do whatever he wants. He has to. And that's the only thing they have left. So you're talking to them about taking the one thing that they think they have power on.
Well, and it's true. And I think, and I read this, I don't know how much stock I put into it yet, is the idea of monogamy being an inherently feminist idea, because it was a way for women in which to exercise control over their sexual partners, which is a very interesting idea. I don't know how much I agree or disagree with it, but I think in the Mormon context, there is definitely something to be said about that, because you're absolutely right. Their male spouse partner is their access to any kind of patriarchal influence, any kind of hierarchy. Like, oh, who is she? Oh, she's the stake president's wife. Well, you know, like these women hold on to that soft power in association to who they are married to. And if he can go out and do whatever thing else, well, that's going to limit her soft power.
And it wasn't that long ago, a little bit before your time, not before my time, that this was Mrs. Michael Smith. The women, you know, back in the old days, we're talking the 60s and 70s, they even gave up their entire name and identity. Absolutely. And you're right, that was their only access to soft power. Yep. is through their husbands.
Well, and if you go back even further, back to European Comstock laws, like literally a marriage was a contractual obligation in which a woman gave up her existence with her man. And so it was just like, it was literally the erasure of an identity being absorbed by a dominant male identity.
Well, see, that's why personally I would push back on the idea you're talking about, that it's a feminist institution. In my mind, marriage, the way we have it now, it's purely a property thing. I mean, we still, without irony, we still call men husbands, right? Yeah. And I just leave as an exercise to go look up the definition of the word husband, and you'll see that you can't, you know, that it is baked through and through that this is a man owning a woman.
Right.
And I hate to put it in that stark of terms, but the problem that the church has, they then bake that into their theology.
Oh, absolutely. So we're going to unbake it. So can anything be unbaked once it's been baked?
We'll see. So where does the church go from here? I mean, I agree that the early form of sealing is wide open.
wide open for all sorts of interesting possibilities.
But it's hard to get back there.
Oh, it definitely is. And there are a lot of people who claim, look, the LDS Church has just dug their feet in so hard. Give it up, Blair. Whatever you do, they're not going to change their mind. And I'm sorry, I'm a Mormon. I'm an eternal optimist. And I'm going to keep trying to put my shoulder to the wheel until, you know, the day I lose my last breath. But I really think that there is... room and in ways showing, like, I hate to use this word, but the church is softening their stance on queer issues.
They have to.
Like, we can see it all the way from, like, you know, Spencer W. Kimball in The Miracle of Forgiveness, all the way up to a Mormon and Gays website, right? So there's definitely at least a small, tiny track record to show there are some small incremental improvements. Now, with that being said, am I going to be like, oh yeah, and this is going to be great and it's all going to happen in my lifetime? And just, no, I'm not that optimistic, but I am saying I will be doing everything in my power to bring these glorious vistas, these glorious queer Mormon vistas, through to fruition.
So what would the church look like in your utopia?
Oh gosh. Well, in my utopia, I would definitely have to take into account what other people are thinking too, because I don't want to adopt the role of the dictator and then become the oppressor. But with that being said, in my utopia, well, first of all, we're going to have to get rid of some gender segregation. And by gender segregation, I mean, this is the full acceptance of the trans community, full acceptance of non-binary entities, and full acceptance of basically any queer identity you can think of right now, right? Asexual, the whole nine yards. I would like to see plural ceilings be made available to anyone. Anyone can have a plural ceiling, and being able to undo ceilings. I think that that's a really important thing that needs to change too. With this, obviously, anyone can get baptized. It doesn't matter if your parents are gay or if your parents are trans or whatever. You know, all children get to be baptized. And definitely just a deconstruction of patriarchy in general. Like, we need to be able to have more women in leadership, queer persons in leadership. Like, nothing would make me happier to, like, have a trans woman of color as an apostle. You know what I mean? Like, this is, I know it sounds just totally insane and crazy, but I'm like, no, this is the vision. I can see it now. It's going to be beautiful. But so I definitely see basically a lot of queer inclusivity. Like, it's so, the body of Christ in the scriptures is described as a diverse body, and it cannot function without diversity. And so to the extent that we're oppressing diversity, well, we need to reevaluate that if we're going to call ourselves the body of Christ.
I think you have excellent points. And I was joking with some friends, not really, but, you know, I struggle with the fact that I inadvertently or unknowingly support a lot of companies and corporations that I consider to be basically immoral, and I kind of have to on some extent, but there's other parts where I don't have to, but I do because I just want to put the blinders on. Mm-hmm. But I was identifying what I call, we can name it whatever. There's a simple way to know if a company is ethical or not. You look at their officers. If they have a black female, this is for American companies. Mm-hmm. If they have a black female anywhere in their officer corps, they are a ethical company. If they don't, you don't know.
Or it's a good start, at the very least. It's at least a good start.
Because to get there, because there's such institutional,
so many barriers,
systematic oppression and discrimination against, in this case, people of African heritage, women in particular. You put that together, like, it's just such a barrier. Mm-hmm. And a company has to work hard to overcome those prejudices. Mm-hmm. So the church is going to have to work hard. It's not going to just, it's almost what they want to do is they want to open these gates. Mm-hmm. But what I hear you implying, which I agree with, is the church needs to become more proactive on this.
Right, absolutely. Well, and I think a lot of people need to become disillusioned about how authority works in the church. And we forget that continuing revelation does not mean, you know, the Q15 come down and tell everyone what to do. Continuing revelation is a communal experience. And at any given time, hypothetically, the entire membership could say, no, I'm not going to follow that rule, President so-and-so. I'm going to follow this rule. So we forget that because we are the masses, we still do have a say in what's going on in the church. So, like, one example was, oh gosh, then this, I think this was before my day, so correct me if I'm wrong, is they came out with this decree or something, like this thing about oral sex being bad. bad and how you shouldn't do it. And literally the membership was like, forget it. That's not Revelation. They totally pulled an Emma Smith and threw that one in the fireplace. It was like, not happening. And so that's just like one small example of like when people in authority are abusing their power and micromanaging how people are living their lives. It's like the masses can collectively say, no, that's not Revelation. That one's going in the garbage.
They can. And the church is held up. This is, I got in trouble a few years ago because I wrote a little essay where I kind of chided people who don't really believe in the church, who keep it up to date. People mm-hmm. like yourself. I've since repented for that. But the idea is the same, which is if all the liberal Mormons don't really, if they all walked out of church tomorrow, the church would collapse. And I think the point you have is right, you know, and this goes to the cities, you know, cities of 45,000 people probably have maybe 5 cops on duty, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. The reason our legal system, our court system, all that works is because we all invest in it. Mm-hmm. You mean, even if 20% of the people who are supposed to make an appearance in court this week stopped going, mm-hmm. the whole system would collapse. And you're right. And this is why I think it's important to have activists like yourself. I mean, people like me, we just say, we're done with it, and we walk out. but that's a certain type of pressure we put on the church. But mm-hmm. there's others who put a better or give the church a path. I don't give the church any quarter.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and just to clarify my position too, I'm in no position whatsoever to tell anyone their right path with the church, right?
What do you mean you're doing it right now?
I know. I'm like, as long as it's the queer path, you guys, come on. No, but like, I really understand that there are some people, like, the best statement you can make is to completely walk away. The best statement someone else can make is to be on the high council. Like, whatever it is you're doing, I'm not really in a position to tell you where your faith journey needs to take you. But what I do want to tell you is that we can all do better about being inclusive and creating narratives that create essentially a safer place for LGBTQ people.
Well, and I think when I look back at, like, say, the civil rights movement in the 60s, you had a lot of people like Slick and those leaders who were looking for peaceful protest, you know, Martin Luther King and a lot of those other leaders. But you also, that was on one hand, you know, and they were ready to get in your face, but they were peaceful. Mm-hmm. Then you had the Black Panthers and other riots that were coming. And I really think that the white power structure, I believe, would never have fully listened to King. It was, they realized if they didn't do King, they had another, that, you know, we had Black Panthers who were arming themselves and starting to have riots in cities. And it was like, we can either go with these peaceful guys. So I actually think, and that's kind of an extremist example. I'm not advocating for any kind of violence against the church at all. But what I'm saying is,
to be clear,
I think the church reforms on those two elements. People inside who want to reform the church and are willing to use their connection inside, and people on the outside just saying, I can't, I'm walking away, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know. And either one of those, they don't work on their own. We need each other. Even though it puts us diametrically opposed sometimes, but we have to say, we're working for the same goal. We want people to live better lives and be fulfilled. We want suicides to end. We want people to be lost in their identity with something like sexual orientation that they can't really control anyway.
Well, and I think that that's really important also, at least to acknowledge, like, I try to take the most charitable position towards the church that I possibly can and work constructively from there. But frankly, sometimes there's just like, no, the policy banning LGBT or kids of LGBT parents, like, from baptism. No, that's just wrong. There's no charitableness about that whatsoever. But I think it's really important that, as we recognize, at least moving charitably forward, there are spaces in which the church is saying, okay, look, we don't want people to kill themselves. You know, we do want to prevent suicide. But yet at the same time, the church isn't willing to say, well, why don't we just invite them to the celestial kingdom? I bet that'll do a lot more to help with LGBT suicide than throwing money at the problem, right? And so I do see an effort. I do see a misguided effort, yes, is what I'm seeing. And hopefully, and again, that's what my book, like, the thesis of my book, if anything, is literally, if the church ever wanted to change, this would be the book to show you the way. You can do it within the theology. You can do it within the narrative. You could make it work if you really wanted to.
And I'll tell you this from my experience working closely with suicidal and transgender teens and those mm-hmm. things over the past 4 or 5 years, the majority of Mormons in this state, in Utah, are supportive. There are still kids that get thrown out of their homes, their kids that get mm-hmm. disowned, their kids mm-hmm. that get disfellowshipped. Mm-hmm. But I would say the tide has turned. Mm-hmm. And most, and I can say this from my own family mm-hmm. and from families that I've observed, people who are very Orthodox are still very accepting. So I think the church membership itself is much more compassionate and way out in front of the church, and mm-hmm. that's going to push the church to where it needs to go. Mm-hmm. But those guys at the top, the selection criteria, makes things move really slow.
Oh, well, that is the problem, isn't it? It's like getting anything to change is like at a glacial place. And although, like, I have mixed feelings about Nelson now because he's making all sorts of changes quickly, but I'm like really hesitant about the changes being made and stuff. I'm like, oh, I hope this turns out well.
Well, and there's a political savviness, and this goes out to all of you ex-Mormon and liberal Mormon operatives. Mm-hmm. Here's the number one thing you can't do. You can do whatever you want, but if you want to be successful, you have to give the church an out. Mm-hmm. The church will never change if they think it came from Blair.
Exactly.
And I've seen a couple of, you know, like, you know, my friend Sam Young and some other movements, ordained women, of things that I fully support. But I think tactically they've made mistakes because they haven't given the church a soft landing.
Yep. And I think that's true of anyone. If you're trying to convince someone of their position and all you just sit and say is you're wrong, 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 instead of, ooh, why don't you try this instead? Like, no one wants to come out. I know I don't. I don't want to come out and be like, yeah, I was totally wrong. That was horrible. I just want to bury my hand in the sand and be embarrassed. It's much easier to be able to say, oh, thanks for bringing that new suggestion to light. Okay, I think I want to adopt that view instead of saying, I'm totally horribly wrong, you know, because pride gets in the way,
right? Like,
it, with all of us. But it just moves at even a more glacial pace with the church.
And I know I've said this joke before, but, you know, why did the church give the blacks the priesthood in 1978? The answer is because it wasn't 1965. and because they couldn't seem like they were reacting to the counterculture movement, mm-hmm. because that would undermine them. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, things like ordained women, those things will come around. We know if we run a long run of the church will eventually ordain women. There's no mm-hmm. question about that. Otherwise, they'll just go obscurely to a pile of...
obsolete.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so they have to do it. But they're playing this chess game of not seeming like they're responding to stuff. And if we want them to reform, we have to just kind of telegraph their moves for them.
Right.
And I've had ex-Mormons get mad at me when I say, well, what do you want them to do? And they're like, we just want them all to burn. Like,
yeah, exactly. You know? Well, yeah, exactly. Well, if that's your position, I'm glad you're open and honest about that. But there are other positions to take too. And part of what I've experienced, at least in my own faith journey, is I'm interested in the narrative that comes after the faith crisis, the faith transition. Like, you know, you've gone through crisis mode and everything. And maybe for me, my crisis mode was like way earlier. My youth as a teenager or whatever. And so maybe I've had more time to deconstruct these narratives. But like, I'm now interested in the stories of, well, congratulations, you just found out the church isn't true. Everything's a myth. All your existential angst is just bottled up inside and you have nothing else to do in your life other than weep in the fetal position. Now what? That's my question.
It's
now
true.
What? And that's what I want to build. Let's build from there.
So
we've
much
we've deconstructed. Now let's build something.
I'm glad because that's where I'm at. And that's why I'm back. Because
at
some point, the just completely deconstructing and taking over is useful and helpful, important for people. But we're leaving our people collectively, people who stay in the church, people who leave the church, people who are somewhere in between, without something else. We've all collectively dropped the ball on building reasonable alternatives to the church.
Well, and the interesting thing is too, is that, which I think you're kind of touching on, is this idea of myth. We all live myths in one way or another. If you don't, I shouldn't say we all, some people don't, but we live myths in the idea, even like currency is a myth, government is a myth, lines in the sand of countries are myths, and we all live around all these myths. And if you go around deconstructing all your myths, you're going to find out there's nothing left. And so like some people are really antagonistic to religion, and they're just like, oh, you just need that myth to soothe your existential mm-hmm. angst. And I'm like, yeah, that's exactly what it is. You got a problem with it?
Oh, 15 years on.
I'm like, I'm really okay using myths to inspire and provoke meaning in my life. If not, I mean, I choose not to wallow in meaning.
You are absolutely right. And I've watched that oftentimes what happens is there's a deconstruction of the church, which is an elation. There's a sense of discovery, mm-hmm. of newness, and there's oftentimes a full embracing of like scientific method or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you start seeing people start talking about science in the same terms that the religious people talk about faith.
Oh yeah.
And I get beat up sometimes because I point out, I've read all the scientific philosophy books. I like science. It ain't all that. It's got some glaring holes in it that scientists themselves will tell you about. But I've been beat up by more than one ex-Mormon for attacking the new orthodoxy.
Exactly.
Right? And so I think this path of watching, yes, you can be elated and you can run your engines off of deconstructing for 5 or 10 years. But most of these people wake up to the second, what I haven't named it yet, the second existential crisis, which is, okay, hedonism has been fun.
Yep.
But yep. Now what?
You've gone out and you sowed your wild oats, and then the, you know, like, it's not like the prodigal child returns, because you don't go back to the myth you went to. You build something new instead.
Right, right.
And that's, to me, that's the exciting part, right? And like, as a philosopher, graduation's in April, hooray. As a philosopher, I've reached a point in my own life where you can come to deconstruct everything around you to the point where you question your own existence. And to people go to the point of like nihilism, everything is meaningless. There's nothing, you know, meaningful in the world whatsoever. And at some point I kind of went, that could be the case, but I already know what happens if I go down that path. I already know nothing, absolutely nothing. But what if I go down this path? What if I made a better myth? What if I said, you know what? There is no meaning, but damn it, I'm going to make some meaning. I'm going to try my hardest.
I like that you say that, because I've studied a lot of religion, and I had never been able to lock into one. Mm-hmm. I wish I could, but I haven't been able to. But I think the two things missing from the secular post-religious world that we live in are myth and some sense of ceremony, some sense of
ritual. Yeah.
That I think those things are hardwired into us, and we really need those. And I think we have to somehow reconnect. Like the neo-pagans have been trying to do this for a long time, and I think we dismiss those people, but I think there's mm-hmm. something there. I think mm-hmm. they recognize that there's something that bonds us and brings us together. And the ex-Mormon world, to talk one that I'm really lacks that glue. All right, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say that's especially poignant to Mormons too, because Mormons are a people of community. I mean, we trek out to the desert, and what do? We build a community, right? It was ugly and we did a lot of horrible things, but like, we build communities. Why do we have an ex-Mormon community? Because we build communities, you know? And so when you get to that point where you're like, okay, I'm done with my Mormon community, I'm done with my ex-Mormon community, where's my community? Where's my myth? Where's my people? Where's my ritual? Where is anything, you know? And that's the point where you start to come around and think, we need to start bringing this myth back in, but with a new mature lens, and saying, oh my gosh, this myth could have meaning in this way. It could be looked at this way. In which, for some people, look at my work, because that's a lot of what I do. I'm like, you're just looking at your myth the wrong way. Look at it this way. Right, you know what right. I mean? And people look at what I do and is like, oh, you're just playing into the myth. And I'm like, yeah, that's exactly what I'm doing. And I'm totally unashamed that I'm doing that.
It's something that I'm spending time thinking about too. How do we bring back the myth? How do we bring back the ritual? For mm-hmm. somebody who's not real super religious, yeah. but obviously I have something about religion. Okay, so there's people listening who think, mm-hmm. okay, you guys sound great. That's fun. What do I do now? What? Here's our call to action. What do we want people to do?
Oh my gosh. Well, this summer you're going to go on Amazon and buy my book, Queer Mormon Theology. you know what? Honestly, I find a lot of meaning of just contributing to my community in whatever ways I can. And so in a lot of ways, like, I feel like even like a Sunstone conference for me, that is a part of my ritual now. That is a part of my worship now. And I have other activities now that contribute to the, you know, my worship. I have discussion groups I go to and things like that, because I don't attend church anymore. I mean, someday I might go back to church, but right now, just with the current LGBT climate, it's just too complicated. So, I mean, I would encourage people to embrace their own inner God, in a sense that you can go out and make meaning. You get to control the story. You get to control the narrative, and your interpretation of Mormonism, be creative with it. Read about it, and it's just as legitimate as anyone else's. And then if we start to bring all these different views of Mormonism together, like, we're going to come up with something that's really just awesome, right? Like, but Mormons, we don't do theology. We just kind of sit there and listen and regurgitate. And I'm saying, yeah, let's do theology.
But you're exactly right. And we've ceded that ground to the right. I can't tell you how many times I've sat in fast and testimony meeting and heard things about guns, heard things about right-wing politics, heard things about, you know, Western grazing rights, and these like yeah. political issues that are on the right that have been fully and openly tolerated in the church. I think that I think liberals in the church and those who have a more progressive view on this stuff, they need to take what has been used by the right for so long in terms of bullying. You know, as I became basically left-leaning, or I don't identify as a Democrat anymore, but I started identifying that way when I was about 16 or 17 after I read the Bible. And, you know, and it was disheartening for me all through my 20s to be constantly low-level shamed and passive-aggressively beat up on once a month in church. But what I'm saying is, here's a window. I get letters all the time that are of the same basic format. They are people who are going through a faith crisis, and they reach out to me. And I've given two general pieces of advice to these people all the time. Slow down. Mm-hmm. There's no hurry. You're in charge. And the second one is just the flip side of that, which is take back your own power. You can say no. You don't have to ask the bishop to release you.
You say who, you say when.
I am finishing this calling in 2 weeks. And, you know, when the clerk calls you, you can say, no, thanks. When they ask you to go to tithing settlement, you say, no.
Yeah.
And you don't owe them an answer. Yeah. But here's the thing I'm trying to append onto that now. Mm-hmm. I am happy for people to stay in and practice the LDS church. But I would ask you one challenge. You have to let it be known that you are supportive of the LGBT community. The suicides, mm-hmm. the depression, what's the count? You know, it's like 1 out of 10 people. If you're in an average ward, there's 10 or 20 closeted Mormons in there. Some of them are in their 80s, and they've been in the closet their whole life. And that means they're probably full of self-loathing and pain that you and I can't even begin to construct.
With that, I would also say one of the things while I was still going, I stopped going about a year ago, but something as simple as a little rainbow button on my jacket.
Yes.
All sorts of people I didn't even know were queer came up to me and started talking to me. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is happening. So like, if you are going to church and you do consider yourself an ally and this is something you want to support, like honestly, just wear a tiny little rainbow pin and I promise you, like, people will notice. I mean, it's happened to me on multiple
Mormons
occasions.
Talk, and we can use that to our advantage. I was going to suggest even putting out like a rainbow flag on Pride, mm-hmm. you know, and the ward's going to see it. Mm-hmm. And more than likely, you might have somebody come up and say something. Probably not, yeah. But you'll probably hear from somebody who says, you know, my daughter's gay. Thank you for doing that. Mm-hmm. And if people will watch you. And if they know they can trust you, you will probably have somebody who in confidence will tell you that.
Absolutely.
You know, get up in testimony meeting and say, you know, I support these folks, you know, and we need to love them.
We have a saying in the community that your allyship doesn't mean anything if you didn't risk anything. Right. And so I'm not one to really like push people to tell people what to do or what to say and things like
that. I am.
Mostly because I don't like it when people try to tell me what to do and tell me my business. So I don't tell you your business. But especially coming from the allyship model, this idea of if you are supporting the queer community, you need to take on some of that queer burden with us. We walk around sometimes with like the scarlet letter on our chest. And if you put one on your chest too, it makes it that much easier to carry.
Absolutely. Yes. I love my scarlet letters. I wear them. I wear them with pride. And when, because they've helped me grow, they've helped me become a better person. They've helped me recognize things that prejudices that mm-hmm. I've been able to root out that I would have all my life, including today, say, I'm not racist. Every so often I find something that's racist and I have to dig it out.
Yep.
So I'll say, I probably am. I try not to be, and I need to listen. I need to pay attention. I need to check things. And this is the one that I and probably every other man needs to work on. I have to work on not reacting to accusations that are thrown my way that aren't exactly fair because they're oftentimes thrown at my gender or things that I don't recognize.
Right.
Realizing that I don't care what it is socially, we all have part of the problem. None of us are as perfect as we think we are.
Oh, totally. We are all part of the problem. Absolutely. And I try to repeat that myself, like including myself in the narrative too. Like just because I am queer doesn't mean I don't do things that probably neglect or erase other queer experiences. So we need to recognize we all need to take ownership for this, like in the queer Mormon community, in the outside community, in the ally community, in the LDS community, whatever it is. Like this is everybody's problem. It's not just one of our problems.
Well, I was really excited to dig into transhumanism.
Transhumanism. We didn't even get there.
So we didn't even get there. It's been a really fun discussion. I'm really excited to read your book. Cool. So I'm really looking forward to it. And when it comes out, we'll have to have you come back in to dig into
your theology
a little bit more. And I want you to know that this construction of myth, it's something that's heavy on my mind. So I'm really more interested in hearing some of your ideas there. It's been delightful to talk to you. I'm so excited to have you here at the Sunstone family. And I think we're doing fun, interesting things. I like everything you've said, because it seems like 10 years ago, everything was so negative. Mm-hmm. It had to be. We were like surgeons, like with bone saws outside of Gettysburg.
Oh, yeah.
But we're not there anymore. And I think there's a chance for us to really focus on the positive, and that's what you're doing.
I like to think we're growing up.
That's a good way. It's a good way to frame it. As a people.
As a people, yeah.
We're going to, you know, I look at even like the Jewish community, like they don't have concepts of excommunication. They don't have concepts of if somebody doesn't go to church for 30 years, they're still part of the community. I'm starting to see that little plant, that seed that was planted, I don't know, 100 years ago, mm-hmm. Starting to grow. And it's a great time, but we need everybody. We need help.
Yeah. Well, and that's one way I do that too. Like, even though I don't go to church, I still hold on to that Mormon identity. Like, no one gets to take that away from me. And so that's where those seeds get planted, from people who are saying, I'm not going to church, but I still totally hold to my Mormon beliefs. And they're going to be different than your Mormon beliefs, but it's still Mormon.
Well, fantastic. It's been wonderful talking to you. We'll let everybody know when the book comes out, and good luck on the rest of the publishing journey. It's a slog.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it. This was fun.
Thanks.